There was a different attitude by the North Korean folks when after that meeting.
Reading tea leaves as the Trump-Kim summit brews. It's Wednesday, May 23rd. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, concerns about Chinese military planes in the South China Sea. Abortion protests in Australia may become illegal. The business of snails and sheep. Endangered species come back. Cyclist app to avoid hazards. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. President Donald Trump said Tuesday there was a substantial chance his summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will not take place as planned on June 12th, amid concerns that Kim is resistant to giving up his nuclear weapons. Trump raised doubts about the Singapore summit in talks with South Korean President Moon Jae-in, who came to Washington to urge Trump not to let a rare opportunity with reclusive North Korea slip away.
Well, we're moving along, and we'll see what happens. There are certain conditions that we want, and I think we'll get those conditions. And if we don't, we don't have the meeting. And frankly, it has a chance to be a great, great meeting for North Korea and a great meeting for the world. If it doesn't happen, maybe it'll happen later. Maybe it'll happen at a different time. But we will see.
If the summit is called off or fails, it would be a major blow to what Trump supporters hope would be the biggest diplomatic achievement of his presidency, and a huge disappointment for the president himself. Trump reiterated his suggestion that Kim's recent meetings with Chinese President Xi Jinping had influenced Kim to harden his stance ahead of the summit.
President Xi is a world-class poker player, and I'd probably maybe doing the same thing that he would do. But I will say this, there was a somewhat different attitude after that meeting, and I'm a little surprised. Now, maybe nothing happened. I'm not blaming anybody, but I'm just saying maybe nothing happened and maybe it did. But there was a different attitude by the North Korean folks when after that meeting.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Carla Freeman about that. She's the director of the Foreign Policy Institute at SAIS, the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies.
Well, I think that meeting was conducted for the two countries to get together to bolster the impression that China and North Korea remain potential partners. I think during that meeting, Xi Jinping assured Kim that China would support him in the negotiation process, but I also think she pushed him to continue to pursue a negotiation with the United States. And indeed, after that meeting, Xi Jinping indicated that that he had reiterated China's support for North Korea's negotiation with the United States.
So you do not agree with President Trump in saying that maybe something happened during that meeting to make Kim Jong-un change his stance against, or at least his rhetoric, to South Korea and the United States?
I do not agree with that. I think that it is more likely that it is changes on the U.S. side that are the challenge, both in terms of concerns that North Korea has about statements made by U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, for one, but also I think it is also North Korea making noise in response to, although it was long planned, last week's Max Thunder U.S.-South Korea military exercises, and really should have been expected to signal dissatisfaction with that.
Do you think this negotiation between Trump and Kim is going to take place?
I think it has a 50-50 chance. I think one of President Moon's messages and efforts here in Washington is to try to push President Trump hard to go ahead with this meeting. I think Moon wants to help make this history, and he's pushing hard. So whatever South Korea can do under his leadership to make that meeting happen, it will do. But I think there are also a lot of potential problems, and I think President Trump is increasingly aware of the risks involved in having a meeting with Kim that doesn't yield constructive outcomes.
What do you think he considers a constructive outcome? He did mention during his words spoken to the media earlier on Tuesday that, yeah, he would like to see an erasure of all of North Korea's nukes immediately, but left open space for it to take a little longer than that.
That's right. I think he has rolled back his own expectations about what can be achieved. I think, though, that he still thinks that he will get some kind of agreement out of President Kim, that the North Koreans will be prepared to move forward with denuclearization. And I think if he doesn't feel convinced that they will be able to come out of their meeting with some sort of promise along those lines, he will not proceed with the meeting.
Carla Freeman is director of the Foreign Policy Institute at SAIS, the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. Thanks so much, Carla.
Thank you.
These are among some of the top Asia stories currently trending on VOAnews.com. As summit looms, North Korea media return to angry tone. U.S. and China near rescue deal for Chinese telecom firm ZTE. China to cut auto import tariffs. MH370 search director disagrees with pilot ditch theory. Indian innovators convert diesel exhaust into ink to battle air pollution. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The Philippines has expressed serious concerns over the presence of Chinese strategic bombers in the contested South China Sea. A spokesman for President Rodrigo Duterte said appropriate diplomatic action has been taken. Chinese state-run media said a few days ago the People's Liberation Army Air Force conducted takeoff and landing training with the H-6K bomber, although it did not specify where in the region. However, an analysis by the Washington-based Centers for Strategic and International Studies suggested it was Woody Island in the Paracels, also claimed by Vietnam and Taiwan. A U.S. defense spokesman said China's continued militarization of disputed features of the South China Sea only serves to raise tensions and destabilize the region. University of New South Wales Professor Emeritus Carl Thayer tells VOA's Victor Beatty this latest development represents another in a line of Chinese military activities that have included fleet actions, with China's latest aircraft carrier and military activities around Taiwan.
These kind of simulated sea strikes occur as part of naval exercises, so that's not new, but landing them on Woody Island, where the airstrip has been extended, is new, and extends the strike range to include a vast circle around Southeast Asia and the South China Sea.
According to China, it said the pilot of an H-6K bomber conducted assault training on a designated sea target and then carried out takeoffs and landings at an airport in the area, describing the exercise as preparation for, quote, the West Pacific and the battle for the South China Sea. What do you make of that?
Well, we often get bellicose rhetoric from China as a way of, there's an old expression, and I've actually heard a Chinese general say it at a conference, you do one, we do one and a half, you do two, we do two and a half. It's that constant assertion of Chinese sovereignty, the firm resolve of China to stand its ground. But in a sense, we're just talking of strike activities. The United States maintains a continuous bomber patrol presence in the region that has got very little publicity, even though freedom of navigation has got much higher ones. You know, say that China flying bombers around the east coast of Taiwan have sort of upped the ante a bit in response to what they think is congressional action on slightly raising ties with Taiwan. It's bellicose. It demonstrates, though, that all we have from the White House, not a reaction necessarily to the bombers, but to the jammers and the missiles, was that there will be near and long-term consequences, and these have not yet been identified.
A Philippine opposition lawmaker condemned China's quote-unquote militarization of the South China Sea, while another congressman said the issue has now become one of global concern, suggesting that the country is now within striking distance of nuclear-capable bombers.
Well, I think we're seeing within the Defense Department public statements bubbling to the surface, indicating strong concerns. The U.S. has, within the last several months, sent two aircraft carrier groups to visit the Philippines, conducted major land exercises this year, which had amphibious components. So we're still seeing a puzzle that hasn't been completely put together to know how firmly the Philippines is going to support an alliance and oppose China or continue to roll over, and how much China is going to I see it as an opportunistic push at the moment to advance just incrementally. And we should bear in mind that the three airstrips in the Spratlys all have hangars large enough to receive no more than four each of these H-6K bombers. But to maintain them there and keep them, particularly even with nuclear weapons, is highly unlikely.
Carl Thayer said what apparently has taken place at Woody Island could be a harbinger for similar military activity in the Spratly Islands off the coasts of the Philippines, Malaysia, and southern Vietnam. He said this development could drive the Philippines closer to the United States, which periodically conducts freedom of navigation and aircraft missions in the region. Happening now in Asia, former Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak faced questions Tuesday from an anti-graft commission probing a multi-billion dollar scandal involving the country's development fund, 1MDB. Investigators want to know about a $10 million bank transfer to Najib's bank account. Najib has denied any wrongdoing. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thank you for listening. Protests outside abortion clinics are to be outlawed under new laws proposed in Australia's most populous state. The legislation would be debated in the coming days in the New South Wales Parliament. Phil Mercer in Sydney tells us in most states and territories, patients on their way into hospitals or clinics face the prospect of confronting protesters who have used graphic imagery of aborted fetuses.
It's estimated that up to 80,000 Australian women terminate a pregnancy each year. Abortion laws vary across the country. In New South Wales, the procedure isn't illegal if it safeguards a woman's mental or physical health. Supporters say a ban on protests outside abortion facilities in Australia's most populous state would protect vulnerable patients from intimidation. Clinics are often picketed by pro-life campaigners who have been accused of harassing people trying to enter the facilities. Penny Sharp is a member of the New South Wales Upper House of Parliament who's co-sponsoring the new legislation.
The bill basically creates three offences outside abortion clinics where within 150 metres it's not okay to interfere with people, to take their photos, or to essentially cause them anxiety and distress when they're trying to go into the clinic.
Associate Professor Kirsten Black is an academic gynaecologist at the University of Sydney who used to work at an abortion centre. She says she often felt uncomfortable.
There was always protesters outside the hospital. So whenever you entered work, there was an intimidating environment. The presence of these people who are quite menacing can certainly be intimidating.
But this anti-abortion protester in Sydney, who wouldn't give his name, believes they have a right to express their views, even if they cause distress.
We take the view that if it's going to save a life, then a bit of confrontation is very well worth it.
In 2015, the state of Victoria passed a law that made it illegal for anti-abortion groups to harass or film people within 150 metres of a clinic. It is similar to the legislation to be considered in the New South Wales Parliament. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, slimy snails are ready to make you beautiful. You're listening to VOA Asia.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on The Voice of America.
This news from VOA Asia. A commemorative coin featuring U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un has been struck by the White House Communications Agency ahead of their planned summit next month. The agency regularly issues commemorative coins to present to foreign guests, diplomats, and members of the military. We present VOA Asia Facebook to you anytime you wish to visit. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, raising snails for beauty products and regulations for sheep farmers in Australia are the topics on today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
At a farm in Nakhon Nayok Province, just a two-hour drive northeast of Bangkok, Thailand, farmers are cultivating giant African snails for their mucus. They say the gooey substance is full of collagen and can help promote younger-looking skin without scars and imperfections. But the key is to keep the snails happy. At this farm, snails roam free, eat organic, and even get a four-month vacation from mucus extraction. Farmers say a happier snail will produce higher quality mucus than ones that are agitated. Tawachai Manimart is a snail farmer.
If we nurture them and keep them happy by providing a pleasant habitat and good food, they'll be healthy. The mucus that they produce will also benefit us by generating more profits.
Once collected, the snail mucus is turned into powder, which is then sold to cosmetic companies in South Korea and the United States. Tawachai says his snails earn him an average monthly income of $940, almost five times the country's $193 minimum monthly wage. Other countries, including Chile, France, and Italy, are also breeding snails for their mucus. Farmers in Australia are breathing a sigh of relief after the Australian government rejected a ban on live sheep exports. The proposal came up after 2,400 sheep died from heat stress, overcrowding, and a lack of water on their way to the Middle East in August of 2017. Fiona Simpson is the president of the Australian National Farmers Federation.
We saw the devastating effects of the ban on the livestock industry in 2011, and those effects were widespread, not just contained to the north of Australia and that area. They were very widespread.
Australia announced that it will instead require ships carrying live cattle and sheep exports to have an independent observer that ensures animal welfare standards. It also plans to introduce new legislation that will penalize exporters that violate these standards, potentially charging them with up to 10 years in prison or fining them up to $1.58 million. Australian Agricultural Minister David Littleproud assured farmers he would reinforce the live animal import-export business with the country's key trading partners.
Well, look, I've already reached out to our trading partners, and it's important we understand this is an important part of our trade, not just for agriculture, but for the entire nation. And in fact, next week, I intend to visit those key trading partners to let them understand how important they are to us, and that what we have put in place, a framework that we have put in place, will make sure there is a sustainable and viable live trade industry into the future.
The live cattle and sheep trade is a $1.3 billion industry. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia, the director of a seabed hunt for Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 disagrees with a new book's conclusion that the pilot likely flew the plane beyond the search area to deliberately sink it in unexplored depths of the Indian Ocean. The Australian Transport Safety Bureau believes the airliner most likely ran out of fuel. You'll find the latest developments on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, conservationists around the world are making great strides in rescuing animal species from the brink of extinction. In spite of the recent death of the last male white rhinoceros, there is hope that science can bring the species back. In Europe, scientists are raising bison almost a century after they vanished from the wild. And California's population of sea otters has rebounded from only 50 specimens in the 1930s. VOA's one-of-a-kind George Pudich has more.
The world's last male northern white rhino, named Sudan, died on March 19th without leaving any offspring. Previous attempts to mate him with either of the last two females of the same subspecies were unsuccessful, and they were deemed unable to reproduce. But scientists preserved Sudan's semen for possible artificial insemination. First, though, they have to test the procedure on six female southern white rhinos at the San Diego Zoo. If everything goes well, they plan to use these distant cousins of the northern white rhinos as surrogate mothers for northern white rhino embryos.
We want them to have the experience of carrying a fetus to term, giving birth and raising a calf, so that in the future, when we have northern white rhino embryos that we're going to implant into these females, we know that they're capable of maintaining pregnancy, giving birth, and raising a calf.
European bison, a taller relative of American bison, once roamed the old continent from the Iberian Peninsula to eastern Russia. They became extinct in the wild in the 1920s, but a small number were preserved in Poland. Now they're being sent to various European countries, including Spain.
So if there are bison in Spain, these bison will adapt to a new flora, fauna, climate, a different form of behavior, different amounts of daylight. Therefore, their genes will be modified. That is, we're going to enrich the species. So a male bison here who was born here and who has different genes will be sent to Poland to enrich the species there. That is the way to ensure the species avoids extinction.
California sea otters have the thickest fur of any animal, so there's no wonder that hunting drove these playful carnivores to near extinction. It took legislation by state and federal authorities to save them.
The biggest impact was essentially eliminating hunting in the early days, and then the population itself has mostly been allowed to expand naturally through just reproduction. And so it's grown from a group of about 50 animals up to the current population, which is about 3,000 animals.
But conservationists would like those numbers to grow so otters can return to their historic range and restore balance to the coastal ecosystem. George Putich, VOA News.
Automobile drivers can choose from several GPS apps that can alert them to accidents or slow traffic so they can avoid them. But riders on bicycles who travel the same roadways as cars are pretty much on their own. VOA's Faith Labadis tells us of an English university student who designed an app to help cyclists report dangerous hotspots to other cyclists and local governments.
It's called Flare, and it looks like an ordinary light you clip onto your handlebars. But Jake Thompson, a product design student at the University of Sussex, says the three buttons on its surface let cyclists report problems they encounter on roads the moment they see them.
Any of the data points that you can press are poor road surface, which covers potholes and broken road surfaces, and even glass on the roads, which you can specify after you drop the data point. The second one is road danger. So if you experience a close pass or a near miss, and you feel a danger on the road, after you have experienced that, you can press that button to highlight that. And the last one is the junction danger. So hard to navigate or busy junction that's poorly designed, that you want to flag up as a place for potential redesign.
Each click of a button sends the location of that problem to a phone app. After their ride, cyclists confirm their flares on the app and add comments. Their reports can be loaded onto a map. Thompson says that data can show local governments where to target funds for road repairs to give everyone a smoother ride. Thompson has been contacted by local authorities in California and Australia about setting up pilot schemes there for what he calls the first app-integrated smart bicycle light. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us online at iTunes and SoundCloud. Stream our program every day on VOA Asia Facebook or our website at voanews.com. By the way, we want to hear from you. You can send us an email. voaasia@voanews.com is our address. We'd also like to thank everyone listening today on the radio, Falcon Radio at Adamson University in the Philippines. Thanks to everyone there, as well as our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Kelvin Fowler, managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a nice day ahead.